Well, tonight we come to Revelation chapter 14. With this, we're actually then going to pause a while, and we're going to be considering Genesis, a portion of that, next week, God willing. And so, appropriately, we have as the title, A Happy Ending for Some. A Happy Ending for Some. For what we have before us here, we remind ourselves again, is a rehearsal of the history that has been the focus of the book of Revelation, which is the here and the now. It is what is happening now, the earth, in the heavenlies. And crowning all, that clear view of what the end will be. And this is a reprise. We've already seen this elsewhere. We've had in Revelation chapter 7, seen the victory there. We've seen it in Revelation chapter 11. And once more, we have it laid before us here, the summation of all things there, when Christ himself shall come, the judge of all the earth. So it is this same period that Revelation, looking at chapters 6 and 7, chapters 8 and 9, and the trumpets, now, the world that we are living in. Visions, for sure, we have to interpret those as carefully as we can. But pointing us forward, and were we to just cast our eye there into chapter 15, because of course this is an artificial break in a way that we bring at the end of Revelation 14, but were we to look on, well, we'll see once more, great victory there, the song of Moses, the servant of God, in chapter 15, verse 3, and saying, Great and marvellous are your works, Lord God Almighty, just and true are your ways, O King of the saints. Who shall not fear you, O Lord, and glorify your name? For you alone are holy. For all nations shall come and worship before you, for your judgments have been manifested. Great song of triumph, a great song of victory. And what we see in effect in chapter 14, switching quickly between one thing and another thing. On the one hand, here is the happy ending for God's people. We see the victory. We see the defeats of evil and sin. We see the harvest of souls, our souls there. We see the Lamb with the 144,000 standing on Mount Zion. We see the conclusion of all things, the Lord's people in absolute peace and security. That is there. But then, looking in quick succession, we go to and fro, the victory there and all of the wonder of that. But then on the other hand, it's not such a happy ending for others. A happy ending for some, but not for others. And we see the people in their rebellion upon the earth, and we see the outcome for them, a judgment, a sharp sickle and all graphically displayed there, the judgment, the winepress of God's wrath. So we see both. Simultaneously, we see the destination, God's people, we see their place belonging to the Lamb, foreheads marked with God's name, but then we see the world in its rebellion and with the ending that awaits it. So, first heading, purity of heaven. The purity of heaven. Well, we've mentioned already, mentioned it again, there are the 144,000. That takes us back to Revelation chapter 7, verse 4. That completed number of the redeemed. Old covenant believers, 12 tribes of Israel representing them. But then all, the church as now is expanded geographically, taking in all the nations and peoples with the 12 apostles, humanly speaking, as the foundation of that particular work. So there's the maths that we do, and 12 times 12, and add a few thousands, as it were, on the end of it there, and you end up with 144,000. Symbolic, the number, but indicating. Great number. Great number of people. All of them there, completed, all of them there, owing in a sense their origin in this place to the work and ministry of the Old Testament and the New Testament believers. Head sealed, protected, their owned by God's. They are first fruits. This we were thinking of a little bit in Romans chapter 11, that designated part that is offered up to God, that is especially holy and sanctified. And showing forth there the separation of God's people unto him, sanctified, placed apart for him, his own people, carrying there the seal of his ownership and all the protection and security that follows from that. A redeemed people, as they are described there to us in verse 3. Redeemed from the earth. That would be in a very negative sense in which the earth is spoken of. That is the world of men. That is the world of sin and rebellion. They have been redeemed from it, separated from it, placed instead under Christ's care. And they are a worshipping people. There we find them in verse 2. We find them singing indeed with a voice of many waters, a voice of loud thunder, and the sound of harpists playing. They sang, as it were, a new song before the throne. There's worship. The people are singing. They are singing with great feeling and great warmth. They are singing this new song, which only they are able to sing, because it's a song about redemption. It's a song about what Christ has done for his people. Oh, public meetings, Christmas time and such times, people are singing hymns there and singing great words. But sadly, of course, many of the words they don't know by experience. They don't know of that Christ. They can't truly sing meaningfully about him, because they have no living experience of his power and grace. Only the redeemed truly can sing, know it, understand it, find joy, delight in thinking of what the Lord did for his people. So there they are, and only they, able to sing this new song of redemption. No sense this makes to the world. It has no living experience, no value that it can truly place in the blood of Christ. Only the Lord's people can see that. And there is beauty attending this music. There are the harpists playing their harps, instruments that are suggestive of victory, of peace, the harpists playing to that end. And we shouldn't, and really just by way, somewhat of an aside here, think therefore that harps exhaust all of the instruments that you'll find in heaven. Well, I suspect there'll be some instruments that will be missing in heaven, but I also suspect there are many more that will be there in heaven besides the harp. The harp is merely an illustration of the beauty of all that is happening there and the kind of music that is being sung. And it is not exhaustive of all that heaven's music will be composed of. So, without trivializing it, as the world often does in depicting heaven just with harps and things, well, that is really, I think, there to trivialize what God intended us to take away from this particular picture. And we see in heaven the privilege of Christians, their beliefs and their convictions. We see them in contrast to the unbelieving world. We see their security and we see their peace. And then there is the world in all of its confusion and chaos, while the angels there, and we'll come to in a moment, proclaiming to them to fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment has come, but largely ignorant of it, and not feeling the weight of it, not responding to that message that is going out. We see them from the vantage point that we have. We can think ourselves already there, if you will, the Lamb standing on Mount Zion. We surely, in the position that we are, if we are converted people, then we will be converted people tomorrow and until the last day of life upon the earth. So we see ourselves in this vision already as being with him there. And what a vantage point that it is. There is the foolishness of this world. There are there caricatures, including, as we've just noted there, elements of this particular vision. Not grasping it, no sense of it, no feeling for it. Only able to trivialize it, whenever they try and touch on the holy things, bringing these things down and into a state, really, of their own folly. this understanding, their accusations, not heeding the truth that's given to them, that they should fear God and give glory to him. And yet truth can be laid out as plain as you like to them, and still they don't see it, they won't see it, they fight against it, they rail against it. Or, if they claim to believe it, why their living shows anything but a true conversion. And this is all very sad. And we, from our vantage point, singing already the new song, being able to understand why the Lord had to come in this way that he did, what redemption consists of, how precious the blood that sealed us. We are in such security. We are in such a place that is impregnable. And yet, and as our first heading has laid it out before us, we see purity. This is to be characteristic of the Lord's people in glory, surely, but also characteristic of the Lord's people here on earth. This great number there, where it says in verse 4, the ones who are not defiled with women, for they are virgins, these are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. That's not to bring a narrow focus simply upon one element of sin and of purity. It's illustrating that sanctification of heart and mind. It is to show, well, not that these dear people were never married or anything in that particular way there, but to show that they had a purity about them. They were chaste in that way, that they were people who were separated unto God, not defiled in the way in which this world so often goes careering to its own destruction. Spiritual purity. There is no lie in their mouth, no deceit. They are without fault before the throne of God. They have not embraced this world system. They haven't embraced the mark of the beast and had that element, as it were, that sign of rebellion as being their own kind of inbuilt characteristic, what is really speaking of their whole character, a life of rebellion. They don't like that. They've got purity. They're holding themselves for the Lord, not for this world, not for Babylon, not for anything that belongs to that. And sexual purity, then, as it is still today, is a very illustrative, very diagnostic kind of area of morality, where that purity is often cast away and lost. Whereas in the ancient world, endemic for all the problems, promiscuity, homosexual practice and the rest of it, just as it is today. And so that purity, speaking of it in sexual terms, is a very good shorthand for describing the whole character of man, setting before us the most obvious of breaking down of that purity and the boundaries of it, to show us that's illustrating to us the way of sin, taking us away from our devotion to God. And so, as our Lord had to judge the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah and deal with the villages that lay around and about, we can see how that career in sexual immorality just goes from bad to worse. Once started, there is further degrading. Lust breaks down boundaries and really would just go for more lust. Out of the window goes self-control in that pursuit of self-gratification and experimentation. Crude language that we hear, that all manner of people speak, whoever high office they often are in, including presidents. The way in which pursuit, all manner of agendas, transgender things, these are really the logical outcome. Sin pursues its course, pushes through boundaries, and shows no fear of God. And so God's people are not like that. They hold themselves away from it, see in it destruction, see in it tragedy and disaster. And, as often these things do go hand in hand, in the mouth was found no deceit. There was no deceit. There was no lie there, not serving God and mammon, not halfway between serving God and actually serving the devil by default. No, they were Christ's, not following the lie. They were clean, not liars, not cheats, not manipulators, not cruel. And in that measure, they were following Christ here on the earth already. And they'll be following him all the way in heaven, following him on earth in tribulation, following him in joy in the glory that is above. How secure, how absolutely blameless, and that we say of ourselves. And we say it knowing who we are. We say it knowing our own besetting sins and the difficulties and all that we've been looking at in our morning series there on battles. Various other things too, sexual uncleanness in the mind. And sadly, sometimes they're actually outworked at some period of life. We know these things. We know the accusations that could be levelled against any one of us. And yet, in the sight of God, that precious blood cleanses from all sin. And we are regarded there as without fault before the throne of God. What a place. So purity is our calling here on earth. Humble, penitent, obedient. They are those whose works that we read about in verse 13 follow them to heaven. They rest from their labours when they pass from this earth, and their works follow them. The record, their purity, their devotion to Christ, their sacrifices go with them. And that record is there before the throne of God. So purity, the purity of heaven, the purity of God's people. So now my second heading, message to earth. And this is the not so happy ending as well. This is the other side that Revelation 14 holds before us. Well, there is this unimaginably blissful state of God's people. The life that is theirs in heaven, which was characterized by their life, imperfectly lived out on earth, but nevertheless tending towards purity. But here is the message to the earth. And at the beginning, we have the proclamation of the three angels. Three angels representing the message that should be given by gospel preaching to the earth, to the people of the earth, to all of the nations on the earth. And it amounts really to the same message, which is that there is judgment to come. There is judgment to come. It is coming. Fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment has come. First angel, the second angel speaks there as the thing done. Babylon is fallen, and the warning of the third angel, that those that have given themselves there, whether in a very deep, explicit way, or just simply by neglect, who've given themselves to the service of the devil, well, they shall drink the wine of the wrath of God, poured out full strength into the cup of his indignation. It's doom, and it is not a happy ending for them. They are to fear God, because he is real. It is the effort of sinful man to try to make him a work of fiction, make him the work of imaginations of somewhat stunted, backward people, to try to place before us the thought that all of this is old hat, it belongs to a bygone age, it's just a scare story that we use there against our children and that sort of thing. No, he's real. And what we're advised to do here, to fear him and give glory to him, is that which we should readily and quickly embrace. For there are not idle words that he speaks when there is the warning of the hour of his judgment, spoken of as has come, and this call to worship him who made heaven and earth, the sea and the springs of water. That gospel is still to be preached. The day has not come yet of Christ's return. The window of opportunity stays open. But for how long? We don't know. And therefore we are advised, any of us who are outside of Christ and outside of his blessing, don't delay. Heed the message, fear God, and give glory to him, that hour of judgment else will find us out. Here is no self-esteem gospel. Here is not something to make you feel good about things. This is it in essence. Here is the warning. Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. That was the message of John the Baptist. It was the message of our Lord when he was here on earth, preaching amongst the villages. And we see the doom of Babylon. This is its first mention here in Revelation. It's going to be picked up again there in chapter 17 later on. Babylon, the declaration that it is fallen. Summing up there, that sort of geographical empire sense. this world's empire, all of its fallen ambitions, its twisted spiritual and all of its heart sins and opposition and rebellion against God, summed up by Babylon, that city and all of its wealth and all of its oppression there from Bible times, now being used as a shorthand for that continuing world system, combining together there the work of the two beasts we saw last week, opposed to God, opposed to God's people, made the nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. No purity there, no cleanness about her work. She's instilling rebellion. There is a lie in her mouth, and that declaration that she has fallen will be, as we would see perhaps in a few months' time, huge disappointment to the world. They pinned their hopes on this thing working, that this would outlast everything, that the comforts that it gives, the false security, insulating people from the thought of God, suddenly it's all gone, in an hour, in an instant, and it's lost. And so that is declared there, her doom, and then verses 9 to 11, the third angel in this trilogy here, the wrath that God will express against the sinful, disobedient world. The issues, it takes away the sort of comfort that the everyday gives to us and projects us forward to the ultimate things and to the fact that God will judge the world. Everlasting will be that punishment. And we swallow hard, don't we, as we read that, the full strength of the cup of his indignation, and we see this torment, fire and brimstone, speaking there of discomfort, pain of this place, of its unfriendliness and inhospitable climate. Never think that hell is a jokey place, or a place where people just get to practice their sins with all their old drinking mates and that sort of thing. It's not that at all. It's a lonely, lost, miserable and sad place. And it goes on forever, as we see in verse 11. There's no rest, day or night. And these are solemn and serious things we do well to attend to. And so that message, fear God and give him glory, the warning about what will come and of hell, this goes out into this fallen world. This is the message that we speak. That's a message the world might account folly. Why, how many people believe this message? Well, there are a small number here tonight, and I can tell you that across this country, many other churches, even smaller than ourselves, meeting, proclaiming the same message, world out there, mostly unmoved by it. And yet there is the sad fact. And we speak that message still. And God willing, we'll be speaking it till our last days upon the earth. But even though, and here the world contents itself, no judgment has come yet. Where is this judgment? In the territory of 2 Peter chapter 3. People dismiss the thought that days have passed, hundreds of years have gone, well, thousands since Christ returned to heaven, and was still waiting for his return. So some people think that's diminishing the credibility of this. It's simply not going to happen. So we still proclaim, yes it is. It's going to happen. He is going to come. And we may be a small number, and the majority of people may just dismiss it as folly. We believe this. And our solemn warning still to the world, as God gives us opportunity, is fear God, give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment has come. And so we see then, as we draw to the last portion of this word, this very graphic description of the judgment at the end. You might see in verses 14, 16, the harvest of souls. God's people ingathered. Many commentators would feel that that is a description, the ingathering of God's people. Whichever way one looks at it, certainly from verses 17 and onwards, is the judgment upon the sinner. It is then a picture of absolute conquest on the part of God, and of him then enforcing his law upon each and every one. There is no question who is the winner. Indeed, it was never in doubt who would come through victorious, but despite the rebellion and its orchestration from hell, despite all of the subtlety, the cunning, or the not such subtlety, the violence and cruelty that it uses, it is total defeat. And the blood's there, very graphic this, and all the things that are happening there, vast and intense and great. And that picture is showing to us the finality of it, and the total carnage of it. So many who thought that they were so wise not to believe in the judgment, to dismiss all that it brings, and there is their ruin. And the extent of it, well, not that I'm an expert on all these calculations, but apparently amounts to something like 300 kilometres. This is vast. It is showing to us the complete, absolute victory of Christ over all his enemies. And so we saw in Isaiah chapter 63, just in the Old Testament, a picture there in terms of Edom, nation, largely speaking, rebellious against God, and of the judgment that was brought there. And the language is very indicative. It's pointing forward again to Revelation, not only chapter 14, but other parts too. And so we read there, who is this? It comes from Edom with dyed garments from Bozra, capital of Edom. This one who is glorious in his apparel, travelling in the greatness of his strength. I, God speaking, isn't it? Speak in righteousness, mighty to save. And so the prophet asks the question, why is your apparel red? And your garments like one who treads in the winepress. And then we learn, I have trodden the winepress alone, and from the peoples no one was with me. For I have trodden them in my anger, and trampled them in my fury. Their blood is sprinkled upon my garments, and I have stained all my robes. For their vengeance is in my heart, and the year of my redeemed has come. I looked, but there was no one to help, and I wondered that there was no one to uphold. Therefore my own arm brought salvation for me. My own fury it sustained me. I have trodden down the peoples in my anger, made them drunk in my fury, and brought down their strength to the earth. Then a small kind of version of it, a little tableau of that judgment against Edom, a people rebellious against God's people. And there is his vengeance. And there is the graphic language of the Old Testament, picturing it in that way, as a conquering king who's destroying all those who stood against him, but also that the year of his redeemed has come, that holding together the both parts of it, a happy ending for some, but not for others. And so my third and final heading tonight, be patient. And this has been the message that's come through before, as we have been considering these passages in Revelation. It's the call to us to be patient. And we find it there, don't we, right in verse 12, in the heart of all of this, thinking here, we've switched in this vision to the earth, all that's happening, the people resisting God's call. Here is the patience of the saints and those who keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. Then in the midst of such rebellious and hostile world, we hold our course. We are unmoved by it, not swayed by it, tempted or allured by it. We see through it, and we have our eyes set on glory. We see what lies at the end. That's faith, isn't it? It's being assured of those things that we hope for, and certain of those things which, strictly speaking, as yet, we have not seen. We wait on God. And so it's perhaps appropriate just to quote some verses from Psalm 37. And at the beginning of that psalm, verse 1 and following, where it says, do not fret because of evildoers, nor be envious of the workers of iniquity. For they shall soon be cut down like the grass, and wither as the green herb. Trust in the Lord, and do good. Dwell in the land, and feed on his faithfulness. Delight yourself also in the Lord, and he shall give you the desires of your heart. And it goes on in similar fashion to speak the Lord's people amidst those who are rebelling, who are evil doers, and we are bid not to fret. Be patient. To hold our course, not to be distracted by them. We're aware of them. We know what they're doing. We understand what's animating their hearts and their minds. Sadly, they don't. We get that. We can see it. But we're not going to be distracted from the message of the gospel, be distracted from building ourselves up in the most holy faith. We're going to keep our ground, hold it, and pursue it. We'll trust in the Lord and do good. That's being patient. Carry on witnessing to them. We'll be part of that message there to fear God and give him glory, and to warn people, judgment to come, whether they listen or not. Because there's danger that if we don't exercise patience, hold to the promises of God, we're clear in our belief of that judgment to come, that we could become impatient. That could be a symptom of the fact that actually somewhere in our hearts, we don't believe it. We don't believe that God will judge the world. We think for years have passed, nothing seems to have happened, the wicked prosper there, no thunderbolts come down and strike them. Well, there are many who have, it has to be said, met an untimely end. But we don't see some widespread sort of shaking there, if you like, that disturbs them and removes them completely from the earth. And we could think, therefore, is there going to be a judgment? Will there be any reward for pursuing this course, for following this narrow path? And that would be sad if we went that way. Or if we begin to think, small numbers begin to disturb us. We feel uncomfortable. Let's enlarge what we think the church to be. And we'll embrace some of those who, well, are half in the world and half in the church, but we'll say they're okay. And we'll count them all in, and we'll make common cause with them to feel better. That's sadly what the church has often done. That the loneliness, if you like, of this path that we walk, the disturbance that it is to our peace of mind, that we're so few amongst so many, that we try to increase the number that we are to feel better about things, or to give ourselves there a little bit more prominence. We lose our purity. And we lose our devotion to Christ in that way. It's a sign of impatience. It's why so much, I fear, has gone astray in evangelical Christianity in the last 30 years or so. Because of the difficulties there, people have agitated for changes and have not been happy to remain on the old paths. Or we want to visibly be seen to be on the right side now. Not then, when we die, or when the Lord returns, whichever happens the first, but we want to be vindicated now. All of the barbs, all of the proud expressions of rebellion, well, we want to have some vindication now. And that kind of impatience also leads down this doctrinal error, so we start there. I'm not going to go on at length about this, but the New Apostolic Reformation, conquering the seven mountains and controlling governments and society, all of this dominion kind of thought there really is often a response, I think, to the frustration and impatience that we seem at times to make such slight progress. The world is all there shouting down the Christian faith in so many places. Let's be patient. Vindication will come, dear friends, it will come. Read all you read in Revelation 14. You'll see yourself there symbolically amongst the 144,000. Have no doubt about it. Fretting does not lead to the will of God being done. The desire for vindication right here, right now, in some triumphant way, it will come one day. But be patient. We may just have to endure a little affliction, although the Lord is well able to bring grace and blessing to his people in every circumstance. So we never deny that we're not going to be seeing some victories and some helps in the here and the now. So not cynicism or carelessness, not dropping separation and the need to keep pure in our thinking and doctrine, not allowing ourselves the anything goes kind of mentality. This book is immensely practical. Though it be that it speaks here in symbols and we locate it within what we call apocalyptic literature, though it be a little alien and foreign to us in our thinking there, this is for a practical help, not for a distant future, not for some other people at some time when we've all been raptured and taken off before the action, if you will. It's for now. It's for here. And it's full of advice and wisdom for the Lord's people, in a world that is very clearly, very accurately described in the book of Revelation. The world that we live in, the world in which God gives us resources to serve him, that we might at last come before his throne without fault, being found there in the presence
of the Lamb. Encouragement.
So, dear friends, yes, a happy ending. Not for everybody, but I trust for those of us who are looking to Christ for salvation, we'll find all of this, and more than this, wonderfully fulfilled in our home above.